It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is the Fox News Rundown Extra. I'm Lisa Brady. There's pushback on some progressive policies lately in liberal strongholds, spurred by crime. In San Francisco, voters passed 2 ballot propositions from the city's Democratic mayor, London Breed, including drug screening and treatment for some city welfare recipients, though sobriety is not a requirement, and changes in police policy and procedure. Officers will have more leeway to chase someone believed to be committing a felony or violent misdemeanor, and they can use drones, facial recognition technology, and public surveillance cameras. In Washington, D.C., the city council passed a crime bill that makes it easier for judges to keep certain violent suspects behind bars before trial, expands the definition of carjacking, and creates a new crime for organized retail theft. It also allows DNA collection after arrests, but it's limited to suspects in violent felonies and sexual assault misdemeanors, and only after a judge finds probable cause. Opponents of these shifts in San Francisco and D.C. have some concerns in common, including a focus on penalties instead of help and the potential for disproportionate impacts on minorities. But the changes easily won approval in the end. And in the same week that New York's Democratic governor deployed hundreds of National Guard members to help crack down on violent crime in New York City subways. So we spoke with Rafael Mangual, the Nick O'Neill Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, about these shifts away from progressive policies, concern that some changes could do more harm than good, and whether it's all just politics. We made some edits for time and thought you might want to hear the whole thing. Thanks for listening. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Fox News Rundown weekday podcast. Now here's Rafael Mangual on the Fox News Rundown Extra. Before we dig a little deeper into the changes being made in D.C. and San Francisco, just to look at the big picture for a minute, how significant is it that 2 liberal areas with Democratic mayors are making changes to address crime?
Look, I think it's an important recognition of, you know, that the last few years have not been working. You know, the cynic in me wants to say that the election season has something to do with it. But you know, we'll take what we can get whenever we can get it. You know, I do think these are moves in a positive direction. Is it as far as I would like to see these places go? No, but we got to start somewhere. And I think this is some positive motion.
There is a headline in one piece in the San Francisco Chronicle that says voters make it clear San Francisco can no longer be called a progressive city. Is that overstating what's happening at this point, though, at least in terms of, you know, reversing some of the policies that critics say have helped fuel more crime?
I'd say so. I mean, it sounds to me like that headline's really just an attempt to redefine progressivism, you know, to include, you know, to sort of restrict it to anarchism, right? Even the most progressive people understand that public safety is an important component of how cities function, right? You can't have a functioning society if people cannot take for granted that they're not going to be assaulted or accosted when they leave the house. Otherwise, the economy doesn't work, right? You can't go out and participate. Everyone's stuck in their house. You know, my property law professor in law school used to call it the 12-gauge solution, right? This is why we have property law. Otherwise, we would all just sit on our porches with a 12-gauge protecting our things because we wouldn't have confidence that the state could actually, you know, do its job. I think that headline probably takes it a little too far.
One of the changes in San Francisco is something that Republicans have historically proposed, a drug testing requirement for welfare recipients. It applies to single adults, no dependents. They would have an addiction specialist and treatment options if they test positive. What about the argument from opponents that this will have deadly results, that some people will end up not getting benefits anymore because they just don't want to do that?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's any evidence to suggest that, right? I think what they're trying to do here is realign the incentives with more positive outcomes, right? We're having trouble getting people into treatment, right? What can we do? Well, we can give them an incentive structure that, you know, really pushes them in this direction. Say, hey, if you agree to get the kind of help that you need, which is probably going to save your life and make the city better, more habitable, et cetera, we're going to help you in these following concrete ways. I actually think that makes perfect sense.
And this is in a city, of course, that's become more or less the poster child for
some
of these
issues. Yeah, it's really the epicenter for, you know, overdoses, right? It's like, you know, one of the questions I always have for people who push back in this way, it's like, well, I mean, what should we take from the last few years? why should we think that the other approach has been working? I mean, people are, I was in San Francisco not too long ago. People were strewn in the street. It's, you know, it's horrible to see. I mean, it's not compassion at all. You know, just to watch people just rot out in the open, you know, intravenously injecting drugs, you know, while kids are walking to and from school. It's, you know, it's no way to run a city. So, you know, I think this is a perfectly reasonable and rational approach to try and realign incentives with more positive outcomes.
Another proposal that passed in San Francisco reduces the powers of the Citizen Police Oversight Commission. The mayor says they've been micromanaging the department. But there's some other things that go along with this that are generating some controversy. For instance, more vehicle pursuits will be allowed, right. Drones, surveillance cameras. You know, these raise safety and privacy issues for some people. Could this end up swinging the pendulum back again then? Or at this point, it really depends on whether these changes are effective.
I think it depends on the degree to which the changes are effective. I think it depends on the degree to which these privacy concerns actually arise out of, you know, the use of these technologies. But, you know, provisions like that are really just a recognition of the fact that we're living in a situation in which police departments are running shortages. They are having terrible time recruiting new people into the ranks. They are having a terrible time retaining current members of the force, and so they need to augment their efforts in every way possible. And that means, you know, taking advantage of some of the benefits that these technologies, whether it's drones or surveillance cameras, et cetera, can have. Again, this is another example that I think, you know, makes perfect sense. Are there potential, you know, privacy concerns that might arise in the future? Sure. But that's what legislatures are for, right? That's what policymakers are there for. They're there to keep an eye on things and tweak where necessary. What I think we've seen over the past several years is that whenever these concerns arise, right, the political calculus has been that, you know, well, the only politically valuable thing to do is to just blow it all up. That's what's going to, you know, drive fundraising or, you know, whatever it is. And I think, you know, we're seeing the lasting effects of that. And that ends up bringing us back to where we started in some ways.
And in Washington, D.C., the city council is basically rolling back some of what had been done. Giving the police more tools and therefore more power is what it boils down to, including allowing DNA samples to be collected before suspects are convicted so they could be run through a database.
Right. And there's actually good research on why that will help. The Manhattan Institute published a paper by Jennifer Doliak, who's formerly of Texas Tech and now is the VP of Policy at Arnold Ventures, a criminal justice reform shop, just doing a review of the literature showing that expanding DNA databases, you know, by expanding the offenses for which an arrest can result in a DNA swab, actually reduces crime in the long run. So, you know, these are all positive developments that are backed by evidence. They're evidence-based, as progressives like to say. You know, so again, I mean, you love to see it. It's a shame that it took this much to get us moving in this direction. But, you know, I think it's a positive step, and I'll take what we can get.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
It feels like a lot's happened in a short time, though, in terms of the things that are leading to some of these reversals and partial reversals, right? I mean, it hasn't been that many years. If we go back to all the racial injustice protests of 2020, I mean, okay, we're getting to the 4-year mark now.
Right.
But still, is that a relatively compressed time frame for things to go back and forth like this?
It's nowhere near as compressed as the time frame for all the changes that took place post 2020. You know, the New York Times did an analysis in April of 2021 showing that since the death of George Floyd, between then and that point, April 2021, so about a year, something like 30 states had passed over 140 police reform bills. That is an enormous amount of movement in a very, very short period of time. I mean, in June of 2020, Governor Cuomo signed 10 different police reform bills into law just a month after George Floyd was murdered. In New York, you know, in less than a decade, we've seen bail reform in 2019, discovery reform in 2019, raise the age in 2018. You had the parole bill, Less is More, in 2021 at the city council level. You had the Right to Know Act. You had the diaphragm law, you know, the stop and frisk litigation. All this is like within the last decade, you know, the rewriting of the Rockefeller drug laws. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So there's actually been quite a lot more movement to the left within the criminal justice and policing policy space that happened in a much more compressed time frame. So I would say this is really a much smaller step in that, you know, direction to where we were compared to all the movement that's taken place. I mean, this doesn't come anywhere close to erasing that progress is, you know, a word I think that they would use for that. But, you know, it doesn't come anywhere close to erasing all that's been done on the reform front.
New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul has said repeatedly she likes to tout how she, you know, helped drive changes that had been made on bail reform in New York to give judges more discretion, for instance. Now she's calling out the National Guard to do bag checks as part of a crackdown she just announced on subway crime.
Yeah.
That's not something you hear in many states.
No, again, I mean, it's pretty amazing what an election season will do to politicians who have previously spent a lot of their political capital moving us in a direction that I think a lot of people would say has undermined policing and public safety, not just in the subways or in the city of New York, but in the country writ large. I mean, again, you know, she deserves credit for recognizing that there's a problem and taking affirmative steps to address that problem. You know, I do worry about the degree to which, you know, National Guardsmen who aren't really trained police officers, you know, haven't been trained within the subway system, right? Don't necessarily understand the intricacies of the subway system. I'd much rather see a larger investment in the Transit Bureau of the NYPD to hire more high qualified officers who are going to be specifically trained to do this kind of work. You know, Commissioner Bill Bratton, who first came to New York as chief of the Transit Police Department when it was a separate department from the NYPD, recently tweeted earlier today that while he commends Governor Hochul's initiative here, you know, it's important to understand that the NYPD's Transit Bureau is operating with something like 1,000 fewer officers than he had when he was chief of the Transit Department in 1990. So, you know, I think the problems that we have are very clear. They're very clearly traceable to two things, and that is an undermining of the efforts of the police that we have, both through a reduction in their overall force sizes, but also just in the additional restrictions that they have to face, right? Again, you know, police officers who make an arrest anywhere in the city are still subject to criminal penalties if they simply put pressure on somebody's diaphragm, back or chest or neck in any way, even if they didn't mean to do that and even if that suspect is actively resisting. That's a huge disincentive. It's one of the reasons why you see so many of these arrest videos where you got 7-8 officers trying to arrest one person, because it's so difficult to handle a grown person who doesn't want to be arrested without actually violating these rules that would subject these officers to criminal penalties. So I think a lot more needs to be done, you know, to you know, offer some relief to police officers, not just in this city, but throughout the state. And on the criminal justice side, you know, all of their efforts need to be backed by more intelligent criminal justice policy. You know, we have a skyrocketing rate of case dismissals that owes in large part to the discovery reform that, you know, in my opinion, is far more impactful than the bail reform ever could possibly be. And yet there's no real talk about fixing any of those provisions. I mean, you know, so that's something that absolutely needs to change. We're seeing fewer prosecutions. We're seeing, even in the prosecutions that we're seeing a lower likelihood of incarcerations as a result. So, you know, all that means that, you know, what good is it if police take an offender off the street if that offender is going to get put right back out onto the sidewalks? And, you know, the NYPD has been, you know, calling this out more on social media, which I think is important for the public so that they can understand what the effects of these policies are. But of course, you know, a lot of policymakers here in New York City on the city council are decrying those efforts. And so, you know, I think we're kind of approaching a reckoning. I wouldn't say we're quite there yet, but I do think it's a good sign that, you know, in cities like D.C., San Francisco, New York, Oregon State recently kind of recriminalized certain uses of drugs. All of this is an example of rhetoric running up against reality. Right, you can only run with the kind of uber progressive rhetoric on crime and justice for so long before reality punches you in the face. And, you know, unfortunately, it's taken a lot of deterioration in a lot of American cities to get people to reconsider.
The endless videos of smash and grabs and other retail theft, that's been part of what's fueling reality hitting, probably in some of these areas. One thing that happened with the D.C. City Council votes is that they kind of stopped short on that issue. They had a threshold for a felony theft, a proposal to lower it.
To $500.
To $500, right? And that was stripped out. So that threshold stays at $1,000.
I think it might get reintroduced next week, is what I read in the Washington Post this morning. But, you know, I think that would be an important thing to do, you know, because, again, when you're talking about, you know, prosecution and backing these efforts, you know, are we really ready to say that, you know, someone who steals, you know, $999 just doesn't need to go to jail, but the person who steals $1 more does? I mean, you know, I'm not sure most Americans really buy into that. And, you know, I think the public safety benefits that could be had by, you know, increasing the amount of incapacitation that you have when these individuals are caught for stealing significant amounts of money, like $500 is not a small amount of money. And it's certainly not when you're talking about small mom and pop retailers or even big retailers whose profit margins are very, very thin. You know, that can mean a lot, specifically in the aggregate. So, I do hope that provision gets reintroduced. And you know, I think that's going to be incredibly important. And, you know, we have so many examples from around the country. I mean, California with Proposition 47, I think, is another example of that. I mean, should we really accept the idea that it's just a coincidence that retail theft has exploded in the wake of that? You know, yeah, I think people are starting to wake up.
On the issue of police tactics,
yeah,
I did want to ask you about the revision in the D.C. bill. They revised the definition of an officer chokehold. That is something the police union wanted. How did that come to fruition when there's still so much tension on that issue? And do you think that that is indicative of, you know, other changes that could be coming?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of the revision, it's not, you know, it's just addressing the vast vagueness in the provision as it stands right now. So it's not legalizing, you know, all neck restraints. You know, but the reality is that there's actually a good bit of research on the use of neck restraints. They're not particularly deadly. They're not particularly dangerous. They're a very effective grappling technique that could actually help de-escalate. And yeah, that sounds weird to people, right? When they hear, well, how can a chokehold de-escalate, right? Isn't that escalate? It's like, well, if you don't effectively grapple a resisting suspect, that suspect may be able to get to a gun or to a weapon. And that interaction may now devolve to a point of more serious force than a chokehold actually being used, where you could have avoided all that by effectively holding that person down. You know, so I think this is one of these examples where we have to trust the men and women who are actually tasked with arresting people. They know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. Does that mean that, you know, they don't ever abuse their authority? Of course not. Does that mean that there shouldn't be any oversight? Of course not. But we should be guided by research and evidence. And, you know, we shouldn't make policy based on, you know, one or two viral videos. You know, it's you know, of course those things are tragic when they go wrong or when these tactics are misused. Yeah, but I often ask people, it's like, okay, well, if we're going to change policy in response to, you know, this viral video or that viral incident, you know, what policy should change when you hear a news story about someone who has 15, 20 prior arrests who then, you know, gets released again on parole or on pretrial release and commits a murder? I mean, why shouldn't policy change in response to those incidents? They're far more common, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so I think what we're seeing is a kind of tamping down of the sort of heat with which we've had this public debate, and reason is starting to rise back to the top, and we're going to be hopefully moving in the right direction, right? What remains to be seen is whether this is a first step in a longer path toward a more rational policy regime, or if this is just, you know, a sort of temporary election season ploy to put people at ease.
On that note, one other question. In San Francisco, critics said these propositions were up against low voter turnout and a lot of money spent by wealthy supporters of the propositions. Does that diminish what happened with these votes in your mind?
Not at all, especially, you know, because you could make the same claims about a lot of the progressive initiatives that have taken hold. I mean, the progressive prosecutor movement's a great example of this. I mean, you know, you have these people winning these offices that are essentially determined by Democratic primary outcomes, which have extremely low turnout. I mean, you know, in cities like Philadelphia or New York or San Francisco, you're talking like 15, 20, 24% of the eligible voters actually turning out in these Democratic primaries that had these huge influxes of cash from very, very wealthy supporters of those. You know, it's like, all right, you know, if we're going to make this argument, you got to make it on both sides. I don't think it actually diminishes anything. You know, people have every right to you know, put their financial support behind the policies that they feel are right. It certainly happens on the left, probably more than it happens on the right. So yeah. I'm not moved by that at all.
Rafael Manguel, I'm going to say it wrong.
No, Mongwal.
Raphael Mongwal with the Manhattan Institute. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.